Well, good morning, friends. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here. Delighted to be bringing our teaching this morning. Also delighted to share it with many of you. We're done with the series we've been in Leviticus for the last summer. Man, so I was hoping there would be like weeping and gnashing. No, not Leviticus. And so we're beginning something new today. However, today, this particular Sunday is actually an interlude. Starting next week, we'll be in a little four-week series on prayer. But a few times a year, we like to pause and highlight our global partnerships. And if you're new to attending Discovery, maybe you're checking out the claims of Jesus and you're like, I don't go to church here, this isn't my church, or I don't even know if I want to go to church. We partner with groups all across the globe. And so you'll see them on the sign out front on the sidewalk as you're walking in. Albania, Costa Rica, Paraguay, and Compton, California. Why do we have these partnerships? And today will be a day where we just want to dial it in. I hope today is just deeply encouraging for you. It's been such a delight thinking particularly about this week. But I think if you boil it down, there's two main reasons why we partner with churches across the globe and ministries. The first is that the church is global. So often when we think the word church, you may think, oh, this barn or this community or lots of little communities. But fundamentally, the church is global. That's its primary definition. So why do we partner with ministries across the globe? Well, it's because we want to be a part of the church. But the second one, which you'll hear more about in a little bit, is if you can really boil it down, why do we partner with churches across the globe? It's this word reciprocity. This idea that we don't have it all figured out, and that when we go visit other people, we learn new things. We gain insight, not just into knowledge and ideas, but into following Jesus. We got a call several months back, Katie Moeller, who is our wonderful Associate Pastor of Community Engagement, from our partners at Praying Pelican, which is a missions organization because of the Bible verse about the praying pelican. And they called and said, hey, could we bring out a group of people to serve at Discovery? And she was like, oh yeah, you mean serve the community around Discovery? Or like you're like needing a place to stay while you drive to communities of need? And they said, well, maybe, but like we'd like to serve at Discovery. And when I heard that, I was like, no. Like we don't need help, surely. And then was convicted of the idea of like, and I also don't need help because I'm fine. And how suburban am I right now? That like this idea of reciprocity fundamentally begins to chip away at this idea of, do I need anything? Do I ask for anything? And I think if I'm not aware that I have needs, I'm in major trouble. If the way that I approach the world around me, whether I'm a follower of Jesus or not, is simply, oh, I give to the world, but I don't take anything back, that would be beneath me. That's a dangerous thought. So why do we engage with global work? It's this idea of reciprocity. I need to give, but I also need to receive. But what do we mean when we say that? What is it that we're giving and receiving when we go on these trips, when we partner with these ministries? What is shared? We had some friends who've gone on trips over the last couple years just share some of their thoughts. I'd love for you to check out this video and hear it from them.
By visiting our partners who live in other parts of the country and the world. When we go on these visits, we have three values that we focus on: dignity, solidarity, and reciprocity. Dignity is just recognizing that everyone is made in the image of God and deserves our respect, our love, and our value. Solidarity is when we recognize that we're not actually that different. We can go way across the world and still find commonalities in our humanity while celebrating our differences. And reciprocity is recognizing that we have as much to learn and receive as we have to give when we go on these trips. We choose our partners very intentionally. We really believe in what God calls them to and the work that they're doing. We prepare for all of that, but we also know God is already at work through our partners. And so we get to go and just receive from them as much as we get to give. So let's hear a little bit from a few people who have been on trips with Discovery about the relationships they've formed, the laughter that has happened, and the reciprocity that they've experienced.
My name is John Neal. I was privileged last year to go with some other members of the global team to Compton, California, who minister to inner city youth and young adults. The best thing for me during that time was to learn to listen, but to let them work it out, to sort out what the passages meant, what the Bible was saying to them in their circumstances and in their situations. I felt uplifted by them. I felt honored to be there.
One thing that the community gave me was just a lasting friendship. I met my friend Bessiana. Then the next time I went to Albania, she rearranged her schedule so that she could be part of our missions trip. And she went to a conference in Fort Collins, and she was able to stay with us and then drive up there and borrow a car. And just things like that. So it's just friendship. I wish she lived closer, because she's really more like a sister.
I'm Kathy Barnett, and my husband and I went to Albania October 2023. The friendliness, caring, loving, and respect we received while there was amazing, and so was the food. They also danced in their gatherings with us, sharing their circle dances and allowing us to show them some line dancing. One young lady in particular was a delight to get to know. I'm still in contact with her. I have fun with that.
Mark Phillips, 2024 Costa Rica trip. Some of us got to spend some time digging a trench for a French drain with Jose.
There was like a ditch, and we were like digging the ditch, and we found a frog. And we knew that Jose was scared of frogs.
Later that same day, I'm over in a different part of the building working.
And so Addie was holding the frog, and we went up to him, and she opened the her hands up, and she went,
and
he
jumped on the table.
Yeah, he jumped on the table.
And he freaked out and screamed.
And I see Jose run by, and then there goes somebody else on our team just trying to show Jose a frog.
Later we were eating dinner, and he came in, and he had like this long stick, and on it was like a scorpion he made out of wire. And he was like chasing us. And so I like jumped up and I picked
and
up my...
And she grabbed a chair. Yeah, and it was like, that's payback for scaring me with that actual frog.
Hi, my name's Sue Donahoe. My family and I visited our global partners in Albania on two separate occasions. Being in another culture also allowed me to see God at work in a different context. It's easy for us to limit how we think God works to spaces and within traditions that we are familiar with. Visiting a global partner opens your eyes to how others experience God.
We go and God will do the work. It's not hard. You just need to show up and love others.
What do we mean when we say reciprocity? What is the thing that's being shared? I think you may have heard threads of it as you were watching that video. But I think our teaching today will really continue to draw some things out. Our teaching today is based in Revelation chapter 7. And for those of you who are like, we just finished Leviticus and we're not doing... hang with me. Revelation chapter 7, if you brought your Bible, you can turn there now. We're going to start in verse 4. And it says this. I heard the count of those who were sealed, 144,000. They were sealed out of every tribe from Israel, 12,000 sealed from Judah, 12,000 from Reuben, 12,000 from Gad, 12,000 from Asher. I'll leave it to your eyes to do the work to see that also Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and 12,000 from Benjamin. I looked again. I saw a huge crowd, too huge to count. Everyone was there, all nations and tribes, all races and languages, and they were standing, dressed in white robes, waving palm branches, standing before the throne and the Lamb, and heartily singing, "Salvation to God on his throne, salvation to the Lamb." All who were standing around the throne, angels, elders, animals, they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, singing, "Oh yes, the blessing and the glory and the wisdom and thanksgiving, the honor and power and strength to our God forever and ever. Oh yes." And just then, one of the elders addressed me. "Who are these dressed in white robes, and where did they come from?" Taken aback, I said, "Sir, I have no idea, but you must know." Then he told me, "These are those who have come from the great tribulation, and they've washed their robes, they've scrubbed them clean in the blood of the Lamb. That's why they're standing before God's throne. They serve him day and night in his temple. The one on the throne will pitch his tent there for them. No more hunger, no more thirst, no more scorching heat. The Lamb on the throne will shepherd them, will lead them to spring waters of life, and God will wipe every last tear from their eyes. This isn't going to be a series on Revelation that we're doing for several weeks, so I'm not going to get super crazy with context, but for those of you who are new to Scripture, you should absolutely be in a place of like, what the heck is going on right now? Let me share a little bit about what's happening in this particular book of the Bible. This is a type of literature. If I was to come up and read Shakespeare and then to follow that up with some poetry from Ralph Waldo Emerson and then to follow that up with today's news from NPR, you would need to listen to those a little bit differently, because if you hear the metaphor going on in poetry and the Old English and Shakespeare and the news and try and understand them all the same way, it would not make sense. So this particular kind of writing is called apocalyptic literature, and this is prophetic for sure. But more than prophetic, sometimes, especially if you grew up kind of in the left behind era, we can hear words like tribulation and the book of Revelation, and we go, ah, it's scary future stuff. And that actually was far less the point of the book of Revelation. Primarily, this book was written as a way to understand current events and to encourage churches in the first and second centuries to help them better understand what was happening to them. This is a letter written to a group of people. It was for them, not just for the future. It was a letter written by a guy named John. John's a really common name, but historically we understand this to be the John who walked with Jesus, one of his mentees, his disciples. And it was a letter that John had written to all the churches of Asia Minor, and particularly seven of them. And when I say churches, and this is where it starts to become really important to understand the context, you may in your mind right away go, okay, so churches like this one, which some of that's true, but really I'd love to add, it's a church of like 20 people maximum. These were house churches, little network groups. And so when they heard church, they were hearing a large family gathering. It's a small group of people. And all of these churches in Asia Minor, they were churches at a time where they were living with crazy persecution. I mean, just for saying that you were a follower of Jesus, you could face the death penalty. To tell your family that you'd chosen to follow Jesus oftentimes would mean you are kicked out of the family. You could lose your job. To be a follower of Jesus, it was a really hard time. Their world is suffering. But it's not suffering without purpose. See, they have these stories of friends of theirs, guys like Stephen, if you read about in the book of Acts, guys who were suffering for their faith, who shared with the world, I'm a follower of Jesus, and they were killed for it. But Stephen's story ends with radical beauty. And even more importantly than that, they followed this Messiah figure, this Jesus Christ of Nazareth. He was also murdered, and also his story did not end there. So it's a group of people who the very story that they're telling all the time is one that demands suffering, but one that tells a story that's so much bigger than that. And so when these churches hear these words out of Revelation, there's particular ways that it's going to hit them. And I'd like to invite us to just slowly walk back through this passage and try and understand what's going on. Now, John, this mentee of Jesus, he's having this vision of heaven. So that's where we begin this story. And it says this right at the beginning, I heard. And I'm just going to pause there for a quick second because that's going to be important in a minute because we're having two separate events here. One event he's going to hear, another event he's going to see. So this is the first event. I heard 144,000. Some people are Jehovah's Witness friends. They take this number literally. We literally are waiting for just 144,000 people to say that they're Christians and like really, 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 really mean it. And then it's done. And then like heaven comes. That's a really dangerous thing to do. That's like listening to Shakespeare and NPR and poetry and holding them all the same. That's not the point. The point is not to hear 144,000. That's a symbolic number. What's it a symbol of? Well, the next thing we get is all these 12s. And if you're Jewish, you understand that the number 12 signifies three main ideas. It signifies completeness, it signifies perfection, and it actually signifies governing authority, which may seem like an odd mix together. But here, we don't just have 12, we have 12 times. It's as if with these numbers, John is saying, look, it's every tribe that's in this nation of Israel, it's like the complete number. Everyone who's supposed to be a part of that tribe, everyone is there. And then this tribe, everyone is there. And then in all of these tribes, even that is this perfectly complete, really perfect idea. And then you might be like, well, what about the thousands thing? How does that come in? Thousand was usually how you'd measure a military battalion. It's 1,000 people. And it's really one of the largest units of measurement that's found in the Bible. Have you ever been around a little kid on Halloween? You're like, how many pieces of candy that you get? And they're like, I don't know, like a kajillion. That's kind of what's going on here. How many people did you hear, John? Like a kajillion, like a completed, perfect, I mean, massive number. And they're militant. There's like a military idea going on here. That's what he's hearing. There's 12,000 from each tribe. Everything's complete. And not only are they complete, but they have this governing authority. This is a group of people in military battle formation that are governing and leading. And if we understand how the Bible likes to talk about those things, these are stewards of the world. This is the complete number of the people of God on earth. There are a lot of them, and they're in formation. Can you imagine being in this tiny little first century church, like 15 people, and hearing that the reality of your situation is not only that there are more of you out there in the world, but that you're equipped and you're called to govern and that you're in battle formations? I mean, when your daily life is just being ground to a pulp, and all of a sudden this letter from a guy named John comes, and you go, if that's the real situation, I've got a little more moxie about how I'm going to go about my day right now. Because there's work to do. God's completing something. I am in battle formation. Let's go. I'm a bit charged up all of a sudden right now. Thank you for the letter, kind sir. And then the letter keeps going on. And now we get a second thought. I looked again, so this is now a second moment, and this second event, this second scene is slightly different. I saw a number too big to count. No longer is it a kajillion. Now he's like, how many people do you see? He's like, like there's too many. I don't know if you have seen the movie The Lord of the Rings. There's this moment where Wormtongue is on top of Orthanc and he comes out with Saruman for the first time, and Saruman's showing him the army, and it's so vast that he just starts weeping. You can't count this thing. That's the sight, something to that effect, like times 1,000 that John is seeing in this moment. It is overwhelming. And there's every nation and race and language. How would you know that? Well, for sure, just by seeing skin tone, but we're going to see in a little bit, there's language being spoken in this place. Culture exists here. It's an international community. Before, where he was just hearing the nation of Israel and its perfect tribes, now he's seeing every single tribe and tongue and nation on the earth. And this is a major idea that's embedded here for us as we talk about our global partners here at Discovery. When we hear the word church, it should not be our barn or even the people who call Discovery home that come to mind. That's not a bad start. But if we're doing really good work, when we hear the word church, we should immediately think of a group of people, both global and historical. That's the church. That's what you're a part of. William Seymour was a pastor in the early 1900s, an African-American leader of the Azusa Street Revival, and I think he said it beautifully. He just said, the greatest sign of the Spirit's work is love, especially and necessarily as expressed across racial and ethnic lines. And that was a dude who was doing ministry in a really odd time in American history. That's like 50-some years before the I Have a Dream speech. And he is doing ministry, not saying, hey, someday when heaven comes, as I'm reading Revelation 7, someday we're all going to get along. He's saying, no, right now, the beauty of the kingdom of heaven, the way to know that the Spirit is at work, is when you see a multi-ethnic community working together. That's a work for today. These people, let's talk about them real quick. This vast army, they're dressed in white robes and they're waving palm branches. Palm branches, contextually, there's so many things that are going on there, but fundamentally, this is how you'd celebrate a victory in war. They've finished. They've won. And these white robes, we'll hear more about them in a little bit, but for sure it's not after Labor Day at this point. They can't wear white after that, so it's before. But it absolutely means that they're clean. A symbol, like, it's not just physically clean. I'm not just wearing a white shirt, but I am clean. And it brings to mind one stark idea that we're well prepared for coming out of Leviticus. These white robes, that's what the priests wear. Particularly on the Day of Atonement, the day that you know my sins are forgiven and I can leave that life behind. And these folks wear these garments all day, every day. This is a group I'd like to party with. Their clothing is simple and it's humble and it's beautiful and it's spotless. And that's what you wear all the time. And they're singing. Don't forget the context. Again, I think this is how John is clued in to know, oh, everybody's here, because the singing that he's hearing is in every tongue. It's not just in Hebrew or in Greek, the languages that he would be used to. He's hearing not just a cacophony of random noise. He's hearing a song in every language. And the song says this: salvation to our God and his throne, salvation to the Lamb. That word salvation in the Greek actually is better translated as the word rescue. Rescue from our God on his throne, rescue from the Lamb. This is a group of people that just can't shut up about how they've been rescued. And it may seem odd because they're in battle formation, they're obviously victorious, but it is not their victory that they're singing about. This is not their army. They were rescued. The victory, the fight, that's God's. And the song keeps going, and that's exactly what we find out. And just to sum up some of the rest of what we hear here, everything good is because of God. He's not going to have any more hunger in this place, no more thirst. Every tear will be wiped from their eyes forever. And here we begin to hit a really big idea. What do they share together? What is this multi-ethnic global community's reciprocity? They've come through this time of tribulation. Again, left behind, recovering people. I hear you. I see you. Tribulation is a word that just simply means suffering. This is a group of people who have come through a time of suffering. They have suffered. This is their unifying marker. This is what they share in reciprocity. They share stories of suffering. They share a passion. Passion is a Latin word that literally just translates to suffer or to endure. Why are they wearing white? Are they wearing white for the good things they've done? The ones who have suffered the most got the most Clorox? No, they've all used the same laundry detergent here, the song they've been singing. What they have done, all the things that they've been done to them, they've not just washed their clothes, but their lives in the blood and the suffering and the passion of Jesus. They've all experienced that suffering. Not just things I'm passionate for on my own, not just things I suffer for because I suffer for my art. I suffer on behalf of Jesus Christ. That's what ties all these people together. And it finishes with that language. Can you imagine being in this little first century house church of 15 folks and hearing that the reality of your situation is that you are a part of an international, global, multi-ethnic community? You can't even count how many there are. And can you imagine with just the grind of the daily life? I mean, they're human beings. They live lives just like you and I, only they face the reality that when they walk out of their church door, they might be killed. That's a little different for us. But they face the reality that they're clothed in white right now. And that after a final load of laundry, it's just going to stay that way forever. And no more tears. That's what's promised. We just get to be with God. There's not just a lack of suffering, but an abundance of good and true and beautiful things. And this church is international. I've got family all over the globe, people that understand what I'm going through. And not just battle formations. We've won. We're going to win this thing. We're going to keep going. Have you ever had a moment where you're either playing or watching sports where you just feel it, like the tide has turned and all you got to do is finish? I love this soundbite. It's Broncos season, everyone, where Dave Logan, it's one of the games from a few years ago, and it's just this moment of hysteria where he's going, oh, they're going to win it. Oh, baby, they're going to win this thing. Can you imagine being in a 15-person house church, getting your butts handed to you every single day, and you get a letter from your friend John saying, we're going to win this thing. And everything in you would be like, I need to hear it again, because that is a hard thing to hold on to sometimes. But if that's true, I've got some moxie. I want to get out there and I want to live this day and suffer with Jesus. This is not merely some prophetic book, this book of Revelation that we're meant to freak out over and start seeing the mark of the beast and the Antichrist in newspaper articles all the time. This is an encouragement. This is a way to see the world and understand your particular circumstances. And fundamentally, what John is saying here is keep going. However you are suffering, and man, it's just your friend and your pastor. There are so many of us who are just suffering right now. That you would hear from the echoes of our faith, a church that's not only global but throughout time, the echoes of one of your church fathers saying, if you're suffering, keep going. Don't give in. Don't seek what's comfortable. Don't jettison from this life that you've chosen. Why is it important to share stories with the global church? Because we begin to undersee how people are suffering all over the globe. And when you see it, it just invigorates your own walk and your own journey and your own suffering to say, I've just got some moxie to keep going. How are you suffering today? How is life hard? And particularly with this idea that itches at, how are you seeking to align your life with Jesus in ways that you're just discovering living life with him is really difficult. Genuinely working on envy or anger, that's difficult. Genuinely wrestling with your sexuality in a culture that says, do what feels right to you, that is difficult. But also following his passion in the places where he said to go and suffer, to be mentored by somebody or to mentor somebody else, there is suffering. To serve the marginalized and the hurting in our community, there is suffering. How are you suffering? I just got back. Man, I'm going to struggle holding this together. So just to give you the heads up, I just got back from a trip with one of our global partners, Compton, and we served together at the Apache Nation in Arizona. Here's a pic of our team. I was stunned this morning. I totally had missed this in my preparation for the week. Whew. Man, I love these people. You see El Salvador and Honduras and Nicaragua, African Americans. You see some Polynesian friends here, a bunch of white folks, about some Asian American, Taiwanese, Chinese, Mexican. You see an Apache man in the orange in the back, that's my friend Veldon. This small picture from heaven, every tribe and tongue and nation. Our team from Discovery that came back, there were 9 of us that got to go. I texted them this week and said, what did you learn? What was this reciprocalness? I wonder if you can hear the suffering in some of the responses. One of them said, I'm just refreshed and emboldened in my faith, because she saw the suffering of another place. She's like, I'm just ready to do life at a higher level, my faith. Another came back and just said, I have this vision for how to structure my business, both present and future, towards more of a kingdom mindset. Talking, oh my gosh, about generosity and just a desire to give, a desire to disciple young people. It's just reinvigorated in the lives of some of our team. Dreams for how to work more in the foster care system or other at-risk demographics here back at home now that we're here. Bob Combs. You see the goofy dude in the blue shirt? That's me in the back, just to my left. That's Bob's head floating without a body. He has one. It's great. Bob and Susan, we've supported as a church for years, but they've supported us as well. Bob lives a crazy life. He has crazy ADHD that keeps his mind always going. I'd apologize for telling you all that, but Bob's not going to see it. He stopped watching the sermon at 3.5 minutes. Bob looks at everything as an opportunity, and he can't turn his mind off. we were washing dishes one night with some of his guys, and they accused him of having this monopoly empire. They're like, oh yeah, Bob owns 12 houses. Which I was like, what is this? And Bob right away just starts shaking his head. He goes, no, you do. You do own 12 houses. And he goes, you guys, I do not own 12 houses. I own 8 houses. And they're like, oh, I see you own 12 houses. And he goes, I don't really own 12 houses. I've just helped all of my staff with the navigators who serve here in the Compton area. I've helped them all step into home ownership, and they just couldn't have done it on their own. So I don't own those houses, you guys. I'm just trying to come alongside young people and help them get a leg up in our community. When you look at the work of Bob and Susan Combs, there are so many stories to tell, but if you could boil it down, they are people of invitation. Talking with the kids that they brought from Compton on this trip, who were incredible people, the common story was, I just got invited to go to Bob and Susan's house, or I got invited to go to the community garden that they've built because I needed a job, because I needed a meal. And then I found that there was a meal, or Bob did connect me to a job. And that work or that food got me further connected to this community because I realized I could keep coming back here. And as I got connected to this community, they just don't shut up about Jesus. Like, they just keep singing about rescue. And the more I spent time around these people, the more I realized that I want to be a part of this. And they become followers of Jesus. Bob never stops thinking about, how can I reach people? And he's on a level that is humbling. Why do we have these global partnerships? Deborah is this crazy woman on the right side of your screen, Veldon in the orange in the back. They're a married couple. They live on this Apache reservation all the time. Deborah's insane. It's like a woman in her like mid-30s, I think the story goes. Team, you can correct me. I'm sure my numbers in this story will be a little bit off. Kid growing up in Muncie, Indiana, has kind of a wild teenage post-college time. Then one day, kind of out of the blue, just hears the Lord say, move to the Apache reservation. And she's like, okay. So she moves to an Apache reservation, which is a really hard place to call home. And she would have been well within her rights to stay for a couple weeks and go, this is too hard, I'm leaving. Especially as a white single woman living here, no way. But instead, Deborah gets to town and she says, okay, now what? And she hears the Lord say, feed my sheep. And she takes it literally, and effectively, for the last about 30 years, she relatively empties her bank account every Monday night and pulls into the equivalent of her King Supers parking lot and feeds whoever shows up. It's not uncommon that somebody will get up and talk about Jesus. Somebody will just share their own story of, here's how God's affected my life. We had one night where this community is so hard. There was this guy that had come by and everything was closed. And it's this kind of compound. We have to lock it up at night, barbed wire, the whole thing. But this guy had come to the fence and he'd just been in a fight. He was super drunk, like offered me weed, which was really funny. Just considering, do I do it just to have a moment with this guy? I didn't. But at one point he's like, I'm hungry. So we went and got him some Apache fried bread that we'd made that day. So fun. And a little bit later, he was like, hey, I'm going to be sleeping outside tonight. Do you have a blanket? Also, is Deborah here? Like, let me go see. And so I go inside and grab a blanket and grab Deborah and come back and we talk with this guy. I mean, it was about an hour-long conversation from start to finish. And as we're walking back, I hear Deborah turn to me and like, kind of teary. She's like, I've known him. His name's Christian. I've known Christian since he was born. I know his family. I know all of his siblings. I've been praying for them, and I just don't understand why things are so lost and broken. And I'm like, you've lived here for how many decades now, and you're still choosing to stay and suffer alongside these people. Whoa. Whew. One final story. I don't even hope it's okay. This is just how it is. Sorry, I'm emotional today. Dr. Ross. When we got the list of like, who are the kids that we're going to be hanging out with from Compton? It's like Bob Combs, and then it was Ara and D2 and all these other names, and at the very end, Dr. Ross. And I'm like, Dr. Ross does not sound like a 20-year-old. Who's this guy? Dr. Ross was born in Birmingham, Alabama. African-American family. He remembers when Martin Luther King was rolling around there because he's in his late 60s. When he was 4 years old, he contracted polio, and so he spent the next 10 years of his life in an iron lung, which, if you don't know what that is, picture a water heater in your house, the big tanks. You just live in that without a lot of human contact or conversation for some of the most formative years of the human experience. When he finally got out, he said, "I don't want any kid to ever have to endure what I had to endure, so I'm going to go become a doctor," which was an audacious goal for a little black kid from Birmingham, Alabama, especially because his family was getting ready to move to Compton, California. A pretty wild place to grow up. Wildly talented. He was a cartoonist. He was one of the first drawers for some of the early Spider-Man cartoons. Disneyland tried to recruit him for a bunch of things, but he was set that he wanted to be a doctor. Fantastic musician, has produced a ton of really good music over his lifetime, but over the course of his career in medicine becomes the world's leading neurosurgeon. There it is. To the point that at this stage in his career, he's being flown all over the world to perform surgeries on the most difficult cases. The world's leading neurosurgeons, goodness. If they're like, "I don't know what to do here," it's call Sheridan Ross. Now, a few years ago, a handful of things all started coming together. He met this couple named Bob and Susan Combs, and they were serving kids in Compton, and he loved that. And Dr. Ross had actually been asked to leave a couple churches because he was bringing too many kids and the church couldn't financially support what was going on. And so instead of saying, "Thank you, let's solve this problem together," they just said, "Can you stop?" He's like, "What the actual heck is going on?" Finds Bob and Susan. He's like, "You're my kind of crazy. Let's do life together." Bob's like, "Let's start this community garden right between where the two rival gangs in Compton. We're going to start right on the border. Let's plant a garden there." And Dr. Ross is like, "Heck yeah." And they plant this garden, which he's still managing today. But it's also during that time that he contracts a disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome. And this is a disease that attacks the nerves in your body, and you begin to lose your nerves, but your extremities start to curl up. And when I met Dr. Ross, I didn't know him. I just stuck out my hand for a big handshake, and he shook my hand back. And I did one of those like, "Oh, shoot, shouldn't have moved so quick." I got to sleep next to him, and when you're sleeping on air mattresses on the ground and when you can't feel anything lower than your waist, really wild to watch a 67-year-old man try to stand up at 6 o'clock in the morning in the pure dark. Never heard him complain once. And I just can't imagine if I was a neurosurgeon who lost his hands, how I would feel about life, what I would do, the anger I would have to process with the Lord, the desire to still want to serve people, but be stuck in a body that was breaking around me. I would just want to get comfortable. Late 60s, I'm retiring after a great career. We can hang it up and call it good. And if you want to know what Dr. Ross is up to today, I found myself telling him the last day, like, one of the things that plagues our community is retirement. Because people retire and they just leave. They start to travel so much that they can't be a part of local things that are going on. And to watch how you live, Dr. Ross. Like, there's no quit in this guy. Like, he's a neurosurgeon. They took away his hands and he's like, "Okay, great. I'm just going to keep serving the world around." In all of these stories, Bob and Susan, man, they suffer with passion for these kids. Deborah and Veldon, oh, they suffer so hard in that Apache reservation every day. Dr. Ross, he just suffers. And when we experience our global partners, we go on these visits and we watch how they suffer and we come home and it just fills you with some moxie. Like, I'm good to keep suffering. I'm good to keep chasing this Jesus. The problems in my life are relatively small, and even if they weren't, I'm just reinvigorated to keep going because this is a story that matters. And look, if you're like, "I'm just checking out Jesus, I don't know about this whole global partner and church thing," I would just encourage you, live a good story. Find something you are passionate about and do it. But I do want to be so clear, the invitation from this book is not just go find any passion. It's go find the passion of Jesus and serve with him in the world around. That's the best story you're ever going to find in your life. If you want to be alive, if that's why you're here, if you're looking for purpose and something meaningful to do with your time, there's nothing better. I can't do all of that on my own, living in my own bubble. But when I see it lived out in friends, when I read a book like Revelation, when I am with the global church, it reminds me that Christian suffering isn't the end of the story. Suffering has an aim, and it is a means to an end. It is something to do with me and the world around me. I can endure a lot for a good story. Often it's so much more fulfilling than chasing the narrative of our culture that just says, make yourself as comfortable as you can. Bullcrap. I'm reminded that suffering is worth it, that victory is assured, that the community that I'm a part of is breathtaking. And I'll keep going here as long as my form of worship and what God is doing in everywhere, as long as this body can. I want to go even harder. I want to give it all. So, whether you follow Jesus or whether not, the invitation of this story, the beauty of having friends across the globe suffering with Jesus, is that you're encouraged to suffer on your own. For those of you who are like, man, I really wanted to be encouraged at church today, and now this dude just saying, suffer well, like this sucks. Suffer with hope. This is the best story. There is goodness and victory here. And it hurts. And it will continue to hurt. And you will not find anything more delightful or better anywhere else you look, or no matter how you try to numb. Do you have to go anywhere to do this? Do you have to go visit one of our local partners? No. Most of these churches in Asia, they never left their area. John, all he's doing here is just simply saying, I just want you to be aware. Churches everywhere. People are suffering a lot. Our first day when we got to Arizona, our friend Thomas, who works with Praying Pelican, because of the Bible verse about the praying pelican, reminded us, when did you start your missionary time? Was it when you landed at the Phoenix airport? Was it when you stepped foot on the Apache reservation? Or do you live like a missionary all the time? At home, when you're here, you're a missionary now. You are a missionary right now if you choose to follow this Jesus. This context, this area, Broomfield, Erie, North Glen, wherever you call home, this is where you've chosen to suffer. The place where you've chosen to be passionate. Here is where you choose to do what is good and right and beautiful and step into a battle formation that does not say, we're going to win with might or with violence. I'm going to win by suffering. I'm ultimately going to win by laying down my life, a total paradox. And it's a good story. And it is amazing to see things firsthand. So if you're like, man, I've been wanting to go, or I've maybe been feeling called to go. Coming up on August 31st, after church, we've got a group that's getting ready to head to Paraguay in January. Just encourage you, go to that meeting. Go consider visiting Dan and Christy Rich. Put it in your calendar right now. Nobody will judge you for pulling out your phone and texting in church right now. August 31st. But how are you suffering? What are you asking the Lord for these days? If ever there was an appropriate way to end a sermon like this, I think it would probably be with a ritual that we do here called communion, and we practice this every week. And so, ushers, if you would begin passing, we would encourage and invite everyone, if you're here, we'd love for you to participate in this with us. We just would ask that you would consider what this means. And this is something that Jesus did with his mentees. His final night before he went to the cross, he took this piece of bread and he broke it and he gave it to them and he said, this is my body which is about to suffer. Every time you receive my suffering, remember me. It was an invitation to participate with him, to not just go and suffer into the world, but to receive the suffering and the passion of Jesus to ourselves. And then he passed around a cup of wine. Sorry that yours is juice. He said, this wine is my blood. It's a new covenant that's being poured out. Every time you do this, remember me. A life literally laid down. So if you would hold these elements, we'll receive them together in just a little bit. I would just love for you to consider the suffering of Christ and your suffering today.